Hello, Internet friend. I'm David Revell, and this is ValueSide for Sunday, January 24. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit ValueSide.com. Well, this week, an update on Ukraine, Saudi signaling the end to the petrodollar, and the slow-walking U.S. consumer. It's all in our review of the week just passed. While here in the U.S., we continue to focus on the tawdry political scandal, still no explanation on how those classified documents got to Joe Biden's home, and we begin to focus on the unfortunate and growing number of high-tech layoffs. But there are big things happening outside of our shores also. Around the world, history is on the march. Reports are that the Russian army is picking up territory in Ukraine. The European press is full of stories that Russia has taken Soledar, a key strategic location on the road to Bakhmut. President Zelensky and the government at Kiev have yet to acknowledge this. So as is often the case in war, things are not entirely verified, but momentum, at least for the moment, seems to be with the Russians. Now certainly this is a world being turned upside down, and perhaps the most significant financial event of the week was the announcement this week that Saudi Arabia is open to accepting other currencies, not just the dollar, in payment for its oil. This might be the final blow to the petrodollar. Finally, there's a major change in American consumer behavior. The macro data indicates that we've crossed a major divide in how people shop. It's the reason that we may not see the return in inflation that the Federal Reserve is predicting. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, as we take a look at the week just passed. Terrible things happened in Ukraine last week, things that are likely to set the future course of this conflict. Unfortunately, these events are likely to come as a complete shock to the financial markets and the American public. Last week, Russia took tremendous strides toward defeating Ukraine, events that should sound like a warning to those in Kyiv and Washington. Unfortunately, these events are little reported by the Western media. But for those familiar with the history of Russia and the United States, this all may have a familiar ring to it. Back in the 1960 campaign for U.S. president, a bold young senator from Massachusetts declared that Russia had significantly more nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles than the United States. He called this the missile gap. Kennedy had drawn the ire of the powers in Washington, and that would follow him for the rest of his career. Official Washington was shocked that he would make such a politically incorrect statement. The five-star general of the army, Dwight Eisenhower, the incumbent president, was personally offended. But Kennedy was likely correct. The powers that be in Washington had underestimated the capabilities of Russian technology. And it wasn't the first time. Just 3 years before, Russia became the first country to launch a satellite that could circle the globe. It could be seen passing overhead by everyone on the east coast of America, just in sight of our national leaders. Today, Washington has much the same thinking with the current conflict in Ukraine. Americans are told that the war is proceeding according to plan and that eventually Ukraine will be victorious. However, the events of last week paint a very different story. Now, you may have read that the Russians captured Soledar last week. Strategically, a vital location, as most military experts consider Soledar to be the key to Bakhmut, the remaining stronghold in the area that puts Russia in a position to capture the entire Donbass region. Now, you may not know that this was accomplished not by the Russian army, but by a private military group known as the Wagner Group. That's right. Besides providing logistic support, Russia established a major tactical victory with minimal risk to its soldiers and equipment. So how do the two sides, Russia and Ukraine, stack up currently? When the special military operation began, Russia invaded Ukraine with a force of approximately 80,000. While Ukraine had somewhere between 250 and 300,000 in its armed forces, a significant advantage for Ukraine. However, Today, the tables have turned. Russia has called up its ready reserves, which total approximately 250 to 300,000, or about the same size as Ukraine began the war. While the Russian reserves will join the force in the field, bringing total Russian forces in theater to at least 300,000. At the same time, Ukraine suffered substantial losses during this conflict. The best estimates are that Ukraine currently has fewer than half the soldiers of Russia. Worse, the Ukrainian soldiers have been in battle for 10 months now, with reports of battle fatigue and a possible outbreak of tuberculosis impairing their ability to fight. In contrast, many of the Russian forces are well-rested, which gives Russia a 2-to-1 advantage in theater. Finally, there was an alarming event that occurred last Thursday. Russia launched 70 missiles and drones at targets around Ukraine. Nothing unusual about that. Russia has been doing it for weeks. But what makes this remarkable, there were no air raid sirens like in the past. Ukraine's air defense shot down none of the drones or missiles. Ukraine's military reported that they did not know they were coming. Ukraine's air defenses were blind. Now, I understand that the American AWACS and other radars are responsible for providing Ukraine with in-depth monitoring of Russian air attacks. American planes and other ground surveillance are active 24 hours a day, providing this intel to Ukraine. But not on Thursday. Thursday, Americans' recon was silent, and a major Russian attack occurred with absolutely no resistance. Now, the supposition is that the Russians blocked the entire territory of Ukraine, making Ukraine invisible to American surveillance. If this turns out to be the case, it will give Russia a tremendous tactical advantage over Ukraine, one that they will no doubt exploit for the rest of the war. By any objective measure, Russia's army fighting in Ukraine is stronger and better equipped than reported. Moreover, the Russians may have a powerful new technology that has effectively cloaked the entire Ukraine battlefield, which, if true, will mute America's principal battle support for Ukraine. It's time for American leadership and the American people to recognize that Russia is fully capable of winning this war in Ukraine. Well, a friend of mine ran the local sandwich shop. He was a fellow escapee from the corporate world and came to rural Pennsylvania to pursue a calmer lifestyle. You may know the type. One day I was telling him how much I enjoyed having lunch there, and he surprised me when he said, "Enjoy it now, because it may not be around much longer." That was a real shock. Many of us were accustomed to grabbing a quick bite or relaxing at one of their tables. So why would he be considering closing? He always retained a customer, and everyone raved about the food. "It's true," he said. "All of my customers love coming here. They just don't come as often as they used to. The customers who used to eat here 3 or 4 times a week now only come by once or twice. And that's made a massive difference in the cash flow. Their income was cut in half and was the reason they would likely close." In fact, they did close a couple of months later, and the community is the worse for it. What my friend said has a great deal of insight, and it's the key to this economy. However, it may not have seemed so to their customers. The customers still went in to buy those delicious lunches, and they may have even placed the same order, like ham and Swiss on rye. But the difference is that they weren't coming in to shop as often. The customers had cut back, just a little, but enough to make a gigantic difference in the shopkeeper's income. Now, we can see from the data that this is happening everywhere. The trend toward spending less began after the great financial crisis of 2008, but it really got underway after the COVID pandemic. Now, economists have a category for this spending rate. It's called velocity. Velocity, according to the Fed, is the frequency of the dollar used to make a purchase. Velocity accelerates when times are good and the economy is humming along, but velocity decelerates when times are declining and the economy is slowing. A note to my technical readers here, today we'll be looking at M1 velocity. M1 is the most narrow definition of currency and the measure of currency likely used for small business purchases. So consider velocity to be the speedometer of cash. The higher the velocity reading, the faster a dollar changes hands and the more financial activity occurs. Conversely, as velocity slows, so too does the overall economic activity. Now, in looking at our money speedometer, velocity back in the 1980s was always at least 6. It did have some ups and downs, but it constantly changed hands at least 6 times a year. By 1995, the pace of velocity began to accelerate, corresponding with the introduction of the internet and e-commerce, which made online transactions possible. It was now more convenient for people to buy things, and they did so in a big, big way. By 2008, M1, the money velocity, reached a record 10, the fastest that the dollar has ever moved through the economy. At that point, things broke. The great financial crisis of 2008 saw the collapse of credit, the principal driver for all this spending, and velocity began to fall back to levels roughly seen before the financial melt-up of the first part of this century. Now, if the story ended there, we'd be looking at a normal boom-bust cycle. But as you know, things did not stop there. COVID struck, and ever since, we've lived in a world that none of us has seen. Considering that the average M1 velocity before and after the 2008 Great Financial Crisis was 5 or 6, then we are currently in an entirely different ballgame. Since that dreadful second quarter of 2020, when the COVID lockdown occurred and the economy dropped by 30%, M1 velocity has been below 1.5. The exchange of the dollar is now just 1/4 of an average before. People's spending has gone into slow motion. And slow motion spending is the reason my friend had to close his shop. He didn't lose customers, it's just that those customers changed their behavior. Instead of eating at his shop weekly, suddenly they only came in once a month, not generating enough income for him to stay in business. And this slow-motion consumer is happening everywhere all through the economy. It is the reason that those stimulus checks did not generate more inflation. With that much money pumped into the economy, we expect that with average velocity, inflation would still be accelerating. In fact, that's what the Federal Reserve thinks is happening now. But the reality is that inflation is falling. It's falling off the table because people have radically slowed their spending. They are sitting on their hands and not opening their wallets. Now, I will throw one caveat in here. Should the price of gasoline go up again, that will bring inflation back. And I'm looking for that possibility later this winter. However, any gasoline-driven recurrence of inflation will likely be temporary. The long-term driver of this financial system will continue to be velocity, and we would have to see velocity double from current levels just to get back to normal. As money velocity goes, so goes this economy. And that's the value side for Wednesday, January 18. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valueside.com. I'm David Revell. ValueSide is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own. Tell you that a scandal has captured our national leadership. Recent disclosures include improper custody of top-secret documents, questionable business ventures with foreign powers, and the troubled behavior of a wayward son. Scandal always presents an ordeal for the nation. The president's supporters generally try to dismiss any accusations as false, perhaps a Russian hoax. In contrast, the opposition to the president will likely paint the missteps as part of high crimes and misdemeanors, justification for impeachment. Now, we're a long way from either of those two eventualities. But whichever direction this particular scandal takes, somewhere between hoax and impeachment, we can be sure that the scandal's impact has already been felt on Wall Street. Wall Street always looks into the future, those forward-looking statements you read about, and the current administration is one of the most considerable influence on how we will turn out. In the next few months, the administration will need to meet the challenges of a potential recession, financing the nation's escalating debt, and manage and propose a galaxy of new rules and regulations. Rules and regulations that can range from the ridiculous, like should we outlaw gas stoves, to the impactful, which industries or sectors should the government provide tax breaks and incentives to. Undeniably, the policies emanating from Washington are vital to all Wall Street future estimates. From tax policies to outright subsidies, Washington has become an essential cog in our financial economy. And it will come as no surprise, then, that Wall Street hates these Washington scandals passionately. From the moment the scandal hits, the country's future becomes uncertain. I saw this for the first time in the Watergate scandal back in the 1970s. From the time that scandal broke early in 1972, for the rest of that presidential term, that administration was in lockdown, a lame duck, unable to accomplish any of its initiatives. And the country was in limbo, with no real leadership at the top. This time was simply a disaster for the financial markets, culminating in one of the worst bear markets of the 20th century. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by nearly 50%, and the average stock, including NASDAQ and the regional exchanges, saw a 60% or more decline. Public investors left the markets in droves for 10 straight years. Mutual funds went net redemption, that's more sellers than buyers. The Dow peaked in 1972, but only surpassed that level again 10 years later, in 1982. Now, while we can't put all the nation's woes on Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal, it was a major contributing factor, the trigger, if you will, igniting an already unstable financial situation. Now, the U.S. faces constant financial challenges as one of the world's largest and most dynamic economies. We cannot afford an administration to be on hold for the next couple of years, like the Nixon administration was. Current major economic issues before this administration include how to curb inflation without falling into recession, how to move a significant manufacturing base back onshore and thereby help reduce supply chain issues, how to manage the financing of the largest federal debt ever, and how to increase a civilian workforce that is falling behind the increase in the population, fewer workers for more people. And those are just a few of the economic issues we're facing. They do not include such geopolitical issues as dealing with Ukraine, China, or Russia. Unfortunately, if history is our guide, all of these issues and more will likely be set aside, problems that we'll need to wait for the next administration to handle. Because once the public's attention turns to the scandal, little can be accomplished. The administration focuses instead on how to put out the scandal. Now, Washington came to a halt back in the 70s. Of course, the administrative state continued, but new policies and positions were halted. Stories abound about how Richard Nixon had nothing to do in those last days before he resigned. We are very close to that point today. Look for many in Washington to begin to work around the president. They will try to accomplish new initiatives away from the Oval Office. Look for Congress to become more assertive as they sense weakness at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Those new tax proposals or environmental regulations will probably not see the light of day this term. For investors, we're likely to see the status quo continue until the next election. It's hard to imagine more inertia in Washington than a president mired in scandal and a divided Congress. But that's what we got. If you like how things are today, you'll love the next couple of years, because Washington is going into the deep freezer. In the closing months of 1973, America was trying to emerge from the devastating blow of an oil embargo, initiated by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and led by Saudi Arabia. Collectively, these oil-producing countries decided to cut off their largest customer, the United States. OPEC was after higher prices and had failed in their negotiations to win price concessions from the U.S. America found itself in an economic pickle. They had descended into a recession and found it difficult to pay additional funds to satisfy OPEC's higher prices. And the Saudis et al. Were determined to maintain that price level. Enter Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's Secretary of State. Kissinger knew that in finance, you always negotiated either price or terms. So Kissinger took the alternative. He would set the terms. Kissinger said to King Faisal, "Okay, the United States will accept your price, but you must sell all your oil in U.S. dollars." And thus was born the famous petrodollar. Now I've simplified the terms and conditions somewhat, but throw in some defense agreements and sale of U.S. military equipment, and you get a general idea of what was going on. Now the petrodollar was destined to affect international trade and the U.S. economy profoundly. Kissinger's deal set the U.S. on becoming the world's merchant. From then on, international finance would set nearly all transactions in dollars. For the U.S., this was when our country began to change from a production-based economy to a finance-based economy. Want to purchase goods from China, India, or some other country? Dollars were the preferred method. And of course, the petroleum trade worldwide was all in U.S. dollars. In short, we were now the merchants of the world. Like your famous shop down on Main Street, we had become the place to shop for just about anything worldwide. Now, you'll remember in our discussion of the SWIFT transaction system, it was also priced in U.S. dollars, and SWIFT, after the last few months, has become dramatically diminished. Here, I emphasize a point that is often glossed over. As the U.S. became the financial linchpin of the world, it also began a process of deindustrialization, and that's no accident. The profitability and ease of entry into finance is far easier than any manufacturing plant. Setting up a financial service company is as easy as passing a few regulations, renting office space, and you're off and running. I know, I've set up a couple. Creating a plant, however, to build lithium batteries, let's say, or computer chips, is an entirely different animal. Making the physical plant itself can be a formidable task, to say nothing of establishing suppliers and providing the raw materials and components. So the American economy turned to finance. For years, the major employers for the Harvard Business School were financial services companies, from investment and commercial banks to venture capital and funds of all type. Finance had become the place for ambitious business school graduates. All that changed this week, however. After 50 years, Saudi Arabia has officially declared that they are willing to accept other currencies in payment for their oil. Saudi Finance Minister Mohammed Al-Jadan, speaking at the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Switzerland, declared, "There are no issues with discussing how we settle our trade arrangements, whether it is in the U.S. dollar, whether it is in the euro, whether it is in the Saudi rial." That's as big an announcement in the financial world as you'll ever likely hear. Saudi Arabia officially declares the end of the petrodollar as the sole price mechanism for the world's most significant oil exporter. Of course, we've been creeping in this direction for nearly a year now. First came the expulsion of Russia from the SWIFT system, then came the personal overtures by China's Xi Jinping to Saudi Arabia just last month. And now, a senior official of the kingdom reports that Saudi will sell its oil in virtually any currency. It is a shift in global finance like few, if any, before. and the country most likely to feel the most significant impact will be the U.S. Moving the Saudi transactions away from the petrodollar will reduce overall dollar liquidity. Our country's ability to finance its debt is diminished just when we have increased the amount of debt dramatically. Further, I expect to see the overall role of finance play a lesser role in the economy as cheap international financing now becomes less readily available. For 50 years, we've lived off King Dollar, an undisputed epicenter of global finance. Tuesday, Minister Mohammed Al-Jadan told us that those days are over. Welcome to a period of adjustment. And that's the value side for this Friday, January 20. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valueside.com. I'm David Revelle. ValueSide is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.